welcome back to BNQ Big Nerdy Questions. Are you one of the poor, unfortunate souls who has never seen a Disney film or never listened to BNQ? Well, if you haven't seen Disney, you may have been experiencing hellfire. But we'll make a man or woman out of you, and we'll make you part of our world today. So be our guest, and I just can't wait for you to listen to our discussion of the Disney Renaissance. So joining us on our magical panel tonight, we have Ed.
Hello, everyone.
And joining us for the first time, my sister, who's the biggest Disney fan I know. Please welcome Sarah.
Hi.
So thank you guys for joining us tonight on our podcast. Once again, Matt is off doing his Matt things, so there's no sponsorship tonight. But we do have a big nerdy recommendation, and for the first time, that comes from Ed. Ed, what would you like to recommend tonight?
Okay, since this is my first one, I'm going to pick one that's really important to me. This is the book series that got me into reading, and I'm very passionate about reading. And I'm talking about the Dark Tower series by Stephen King. There's a total of 8 books. Originally it was 7. He went back and wrote an in-between novel, 8. If I were to describe it in any way, it would be like a mix of a Sergio Leone Western, you know, like an old Clint Eastwood Western, mixed with Lord of the Rings, Arthurian legend, Wizard of Oz. It's a weird hodgepodge, but it's a fantastic read. And it's also all-encompassing because Stephen King references all of his works into there, so it's kind of a shared world. Fantastic story.
Thank you very much, Ed. Yeah, one of my favorite Stephen King novels is The Stand, and I know that the antagonist of The Stand, Randall Flagg, actually shows up in the...
He's actually one of the central villains in The Dark Tower.
And I think he was one of the most compelling characters at The Stand as well. So if you like King works, please check out The Dark Tower. Thank you, Ed. That's a great recommendation.
Thank you. Happy to do it.
Of course. So, and it's also a little bit darker than the films we're talking about tonight, to be honest. Although maybe Hunchback of Notre Dame. I could see Claude Frollo as the villain of all villains. But what we're going to do to frame our discussion, first of all, we have to define the Disney Renaissance. Sarah, will you please briefly give us the definition of what we mean by Disney Renaissance?
Well, it's the period that started after Disney had been in a bit of a slump, after the classic films that everyone thinks of, like Cinderella, Snow White, Peter Pan. It started with The Little Mermaid, which was 1989. And the last one is usually considered around the cutoff of Tarzan or Fantasia 2000. So it really spans the 90s, essentially.
With the exception of The Little Mermaid.
Right,
which
is 1 year before.
Disney historians have said that they went into a second dark age in the early 2000s, but they're back to form with Tangled, Frozen, and Zootopia.
Right, that actually isn't considered a revival type of era, which started more of The Princess and the Frog and really set itself in stone with Tangled.
So those films are great, but we're going to be focusing on the ones of the Renaissance from the 90s for this episode. And what we're going to do for our structure, we're not just going to jump in and go movie to movie like we did with Star Trek. We're going to go and discuss the 4 different categories. The best story, the best animation, the best music, and just for fun, the best villain. And I think it's fair to say that those 4 are pretty good measuring marks for which of the films is the best overall, but of course we will pick, all 3 of us will respectively pick our best Renaissance film at the end of the show. We can't include Best Princess because not all of them have princesses. So, the first category is Best Stories, Best Plotting. Ed, I'll let you have the floor first. What film of the Renaissance did you pick as having the best story?
Okay, this one was a no-brainer for me. For each of these categories, I did pick a follow-up. Just like a runner-up, in my opinion, for best, you know, category. But for me, the runner-up was going to be Hercules, actually. I love the movie Hercules. I don't have to go into a discussion about that, but I just love that story. But the hands-down, my favorite story of the Renaissance is The Lion King. It is a masterpiece. It is Shakespearean. As a child sitting in the theater, and I remember this vividly. I couldn't have been more than 9 or 10 years old. The scenes, Scar is such a fantastic villain, and the scene where Mufasa dies, that it was almost an end of innocence as a child to see something like that on the big screen. Mm-hmm. In a kid's movie with, you know, fart jokes and all that stuff. Mufasa dies. It was just a fantastically written story.
And, well, two things on that. One, I believe it is based on Hamlet, so Shakespearean in the most literal sense.
Yes.
And I would say that the Mufasa death is our generation's collective Bambi's death, or Bambi's mother's death moment. That moment in an animated film, a Disney film, that just completely robs you of, you know, innocence, or at least informs you on the death. So, yeah, Mufasa's death in The Lion King is still heartbreaking every time you watch that movie. The way that the Simba's expressions, oof, you know, never have they before, and I don't think ever since, have they imbibed an animal with such human emotion.
Well, another thing, it's a hero's journey, because Simba's chased out of the Pride Lands, and then he's a reluctant hero. He doesn't want to come back. He doesn't want to take up the mantle, mm-hmm. and a period of time passes because he becomes into an adulthood, and then he comes back to take back the rule, and it was just a great, great story, and not to, you know, pun it up, but the circle of life, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Sarah, what do you think about The Lion King's story?
I mean, I really like it. I think overall it's a very strong movie.
Yeah, I agree. So, Sarah, what's your pick for the best story of the Renaissance?
Beauty and the Beast.
And why is that?
Well, I think just personally, it's a really appealing story to me and a really appealing message. But I feel like the characters are very relatable. And I like that it's very gradual and it's very well distributed. Like the songs, the plot, the story, it all advances in a way that's not too top heavy or too focused on the end. It all feels very natural. So I think overall that would be my favorite. And it does have a lot of emotional response for me. Like all of the characters, even the minor characters, I feel were very relatable. And you actually wanted everyone to have a happy ending. I really wanted, like, even Cogsworth and Lumiere, just sidekicks that are like a candlestick and a clock. But the way it was framed, you really did care. You wanted them to be happy. I felt that was, it's kind of the essence of what a Disney film is about to me.
The way that the film is written, you don't have any sense, like the jokes about the Stockholm Syndrome come later, but you really don't feel that when you're watching the movie because it's plotted so well.
Right. It's shown to have a good progression. Though you can actually see the seasons change with like different montage of different ways they have it. Like you see snow, you see that time does progress while they're in the castle. And of course with the plot device of the rose with the petals falling, you can see time is passing. I think that's really important.
You know, as far as plot devices go, I think the rose might be one of Disney's most clever ones.
Yeah, it really forces things to be sort of time restricted, but also has a very magical element to it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Beauty and the Beast, it's an interesting plot because even though it's all relies on magic, I mean, the Beast transformation, the Lumiere, Cogsworth, Potts, fundamentally the plot of the movie isn't magical or supernatural hardly at all. It's the actual action of the film is purely based on love and fear and prejudice. You know, it's a really interesting way of doing it. Go ahead, Ed.
And nobody inhibits Stockholm Syndrome like Gaston.
He can eat 5 dozen eggs. So I would love to see Gaston versus Rocky.
No. Rocky would destroy him.
Ivan
Gaston
Drago.
Is all show.
Rocky beat cancer. He's going to beat Gaston.
But could he beat LeFou? I don't think so. He's the real muscle of the you know, the scariest guy in the whole movie is the guy that runs the asylum.
Yeah, he's pretty scary.
He is a scary dude.
Because he has power in the village to lock you up for essentially no reason.
You know, if that film was made today, I bet you the twist would be that somehow he is responsible for something.
But well, aren't they making a live-action version of it soon?
That may be the twist.
I think they're making a live-action version.
They are.
Of
Emma Watson is actually the star.
Okay.
And they've released a couple stills of it, and they've done a fairly good job at recreating the aesthetic of the animated movie. The Beast look is kind of odd, but maybe it'll look better in most. But Emma Watson looks spot on in both the blue and white dress as well as the yellow gown. And it looks like the blue and white dress shot, she's in a bookstore on one of those old wooden ladders, so which is a perfect place to do a screenshot of Belle, to be honest, which as an aside is why Belle was my favorite princess, because I was so bookish and nerdy as a kid, and I thought, you know, this is the girl I'd want to hang out with of all the princesses because she has similar interests. Is it true, Sarah, that when Belle is reading the book at the beginning in the first song, it's actually a description of the plot of Aladdin?
That is a common theory. I don't know that it's ever been confirmed. I've heard also that it mirrors things like Sleeping Beauty. And in a way, it does kind of follow those fairy tales, but I've never heard it actually confirmed.
Well, I guess that the Aladdin theory, because Jasmine doesn't realize that he's not a prince.
Right.
Although then he turns out to be better than a prince, kind of. So my pick for best story, Beauty and the Beast is high up there, and so is Lion King. But since you both picked those, I'm going to go with my other choice, and that's Mulan.
Ooh, good choice.
That is a good choice. That would probably be my second.
Yeah, I love the plot of Mulan because it really has the highest stakes of any of the films that I can think of. You've got a person who's essentially trying to take over the country and is using scorched earth tactics to do it. And the scene where Mulan and the rest of the army discover the village burned to the ground, it doesn't get enough credit for how dark it is for a Disney film. I mean, and it conveys the horrors of war in a way where all the adults understand immediately what's happened, but at the same time, the kids aren't going to be scarred in the same way as if they'd actually saw all the bodies. So it's a very clever way to do it. And I think the genius of Mulan, in my opinion, is the balancing of the incredibly dark, the incredibly deep thoughts of the war with the comic relief of Mushu.
Yeah.
You know, it's true though, like the plot of Mulan is so heavy that without the comic relief of Mushu or something like that, I don't think it would be palatable. So they did a great job there with the balancing act. And I think Mushu might actually be the best Disney comic relief sidekick, or at least one of the best.
You know, Shrek, unfortunately, which came out a couple years later, Donkey kind of ruined it for me because I can't go back and watch Mulan without hearing Eddie Murphy as Donkey while Eddie Murphy's being Mushu.
That's true. Well, I mean, isn't Donkey essentially just another version of Mushu?
Well, if you remember, Donkey even got with a dragon in Shrek and had dragon donkey babies, so that's a whole other story, but...
I mean, not taking away, the first Shrek is a genius film, but you're right, it does color it, and you hear Eddie Murphy and you think of Donkey, but Mushu is such a well-written sidekick, and a lot of the sidekicks don't talk. You know, Sven from Frozen, for example, or Abu, from Aladdin. Yeah. But in this case, you've got one, but at the same time, he's not quite as overbearing as Timon and Pumbaa. So it's I like the plot of Mulan. What do you think, Sarah?
Well, I agree. I think also Mulan has other characters that Mulan herself is quite spunky, which helps carry the film a lot. Mm-hmm. She's incredibly brave, but she's also got sort of sarcasm to herself that interacts very well with sidekicks.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are other sidekicks in the film, like the little cricket, and the other men in the army with Mulan, who they actually do provide like emotional support, and they do have strong bonds with each other, but they do also provide comic relief. So I do think Mulan is a very good movie overall. It's one of my favorites.
And I think the ending is pretty smart, too, where they use fireworks, which are one of China's most iconic inventions, as the climax.
Yes, the climax of Mulan is brilliant. And to touch back on the scene you were talking about with the war scene, I did want to mention that I agreed that that's probably one of the most chilling scenes for me as a kid. Even though I didn't know like exactly the implications, it made me incredibly sad. That might have been the only times I really like teared up watching one. And when they find like the little girl's doll in the burned village, it's mm-hmm. it's an image that's, I think, one of the most brilliant ideas they've had as a storytelling device. Because like you said, there's no gore, there's no real shown violence, but the implication and the scene and the setting and the music and even the animation, like the way they animated it in that sort of dark way, was enough to let anyone watching it know that something terrible had happened. So I think overall they did a very good job with Mulan.
They constructed the plot really well, I think is what you're
saying.
Yes.
Yeah. And they showed it very well. Like they animated it very well, and they had characters act out what they wanted. Their intentions were very well realized.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting, you know, we can talk about the different choices for the Renaissance here briefly. You know, a lot of the stories they chose in the Renaissance period were based on either historical things or long-held fairy tales in the best Disney tradition. Mulan is a historical, you know, I don't know if it's a historical myth or if it's a story that was been embellished over time. Sarah, you know more Chinese history than I do. Is Mulan based on an actual event or is it purely mythological?
It is a legend, but there have been multiple women throughout Chinese history that this was a likely circumstance. And Mulan is still a very, it's more of like a respected legend type of figure. Mm. Mulan is very beloved for a lot of people.
And then you have Pocahontas, which is also historical, although to be fair, Disney's rendition is not accurate at all.
No.
Which causes problems when they do Pocahontas 2 and try to correct some of it and just makes it really disjointed. But it is based on a historical event. Agreed. And then Hercules, you have their first foray into mythology, Greek mythology. So the sources they choose in the 90s in the Renaissance are really interesting. But I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, but are there any plots in the Renaissance that are actually purely original? Or are they all adaptations of a classic story?
Rescuers Down Under.
The Rescuers Down Under.
I was just thinking about that.
Which was a fantastic movie.
Yeah, that one, and that's actually one, you might have been surprised for us to mention this, but The Rescuers Down Under came out after The Little Mermaid, so it is part of the Renaissance. The Rescuers 1 is not.
That was like the 70s.
But The Down Under is, and the animation you can tell is very much in the Renaissance vein, even if it's not usually included. It definitely belongs in there. And so that one was based on The Rescuers, but that was an original plot. But it's interesting. Do you think it was a good idea for Disney to decide to do adaptations for plots instead of creating original stories?
Well, how well they worked out, I'd say it was a great gamble.
Yeah.
There's no choice we can make for any of these categories that's bad or wrong. All of the movies are great.
Absolutely. They all have some flaws, but they're great films.
Yes.
It's the reason it's called the Renaissance.
Correct.
But now
today, though, like I don't know if really any Disney film that's entirely original is really remembered. It's like a classic. Or like even throughout all the eras, like even in modern Disney, the most successful ones have been adaptations.
True.
Like Tangled, Frozen.
Princess and the Frog.
Right.
I mean, as far as ones that are purely original, Lilo and Stitch might be up there.
Wreck-It Ralph is original, isn't it?
Wreck-It Ralph's original. Big Hero 6 is an adaptation of an anime.
Yeah, it's off of a comic. Isn't it Marvel, I believe?
It's a Marvel comic, yeah.
It was a Marvel comic. Atlantis was their own story, though. I mean, it's based off the old myth of Atlantis,
yes.
But it's in a wholly original story.
That's true.
I think that was a really underrated movie.
I agree.
And, talking about underrated movies, I think Treasure Planet was vastly underrated. I love that film.
That is my favorite adaptation of Treasure Island.
It's up there for me. It really is. I really like the Muppet version with Tim Curry as well, but that's beside the point. That's also, actually, Disney produced that one too, I believe.
Yeah, they love that story.
Well, they do.
You could even argue that Swiss Family Robinson is a kind of a play on that too. So, well, Robinson Crusoe mixed with Treasure Island. So they love island stories. Anyway, that's the plotting. So right now we've got Lion King, Beauty and the Beast, and Mulan with all three have a point in the column. So let's move on to the best animation. Which film gobsmacked you with its wonderful visions? And this time we'll start with Sarah. What's your choice for the best animation of the Renaissance?
I think overall I would actually go with The Little Mermaid. And reasons for that is mainly because it's underwater and they animated that so beautifully. But I would also say that it almost is a tie between The Little Mermaid and Tarzan, because the way Tarzan was animated was also amazing. Both of them are for different reasons, of course, but it's because of the environments. Like, the way Tarzan moves his feet along the vines in the jungle, like, it's something a human could never really accomplish if they tried to film it live action. I mean, there, of course, have been live action Tarzans, but they've never been able to capture the movement the way the animated Tarzan had. And The Little Mermaid, of course, with it being underwater for a good portion of the movie, it was animated beautifully. The motion of all the things, like the, you know, things like seaweed and fish and bubbles, it looks amazing visually.
For Little Mermaid, did they actually do research? Like, do they have aquariums and stuff? Were they drew things as they saw them in the water. Like, I know they brought in lions for Lion King, but did they do the similar thing with Little Mermaid?
I'm not sure, but I would guess so. You know, the Little Mermaid was actually, it was the last one animated with, like, still animation instead of using any computers. I mean, they might have used some computers, but I know that it's the last one where they used, like, the very traditional still animation. They switched over after.
I mean, it looks gorgeous, and it still holds up, I would say.
I think, yeah, it's even today, it still is very visually impressive.
For some reason, the scene that comes to my mind isn't necessarily underwater, but there's a scene in the movie where there's a sunset on the water.
Yes.
And that is gorgeous.
It is. That's towards the end.
Yes. Yeah.
And it is very well done. And even scenes like Kiss the Girl is also, it's in a boat on the water. But the water and the surrounding environment, the leaves that surround the boat are very beautiful.
And I think the animation in Little Mermaid is incredibly important because if it wasn't pulled off right, you'd be pulled out of the story instantly because it's no longer believable.
Right.
The animation had to be on point, and I think it is. Ed, what's your pick?
Okay, I'll start with my runner-up on this one. My runner-up was actually Mulan, because it's just a gorgeous film. And again, I agree with Sarah. You know, both of her choices there were great. But and this all comes down to personal taste, aesthetically. I went with The Hunchback. The whole gothic vibe of that. It was a dark, dark film. And I haven't watched it in a number of years, but I went back and looked at some scenes of it in preparation of this show, and just the bold, sweeping camera movements through the cathedral and over Paris, and especially, I know this isn't part of the music thing, but during Frollo's Hellfire song, the scenery in that, it was so dark and so gorgeous, with Esmeralda and the flames and everything. It was just a beautiful scene.
Yeah. I had two, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame is one of the two, because the opening in Paris at Notre Dame, wow. I mean, I don't think Disney has, before or since, captured a real building so well in such an amazing way. You could not do CGI Paris from that time period, Assassin's Creed, and make it look any better. Wow. I mean, it's gorgeous, and it's strange to me. It's kind of diverting when most of the animation in that film is, to use a word, mature. Most of the animation in that film doesn't even look Disney in a sense. The characters have sharper angles and the buildings have sharper angles. It's very much more gothic. And then you have the gargoyles that look like they belong in a 1950s Disney film.
And not to mention that they, even though it didn't go overboard with it, Esmeralda did have a sexual vibe to her, and that carried through into Frollo's Hellfire thing.
Yeah, it reminds me more of an anime style. It, obviously not anime in the sense of it's a Japanese film, but a much more mature drawn, like, Frollo wouldn't be out of place in the Boondocks.
I agree with that.
You know? Sarah, what do you think about the Hunchback animation?
I mean, I agree. I think it's impressive. I think they used, like, in Frollo's song, they really used the fire to great advantage. I thought that was very striking. And I do agree that even the character designs are very different. If you look at them, a lot of the differences can be observed by the looking, like in the facial features. A lot of, like, the eyes are maybe drawn a bit less exaggerated. They're a bit more realistic than a lot of Disney characters. And the whole story does have a sense of realism to it. And the gargoyles really are a disconnect. I mean, because the rest of the story, it's very, it's emotionally sort of binding, just because when you look at it, it can really happen. A lot of it can. And I think the realistic animation kind of draws into that with, like, the realistic fears in the story and creates a very good atmosphere. I mean, well, not necessarily good in, like, the sense of comfortable, but a very impressive.
I also don't think it's an accident that The Hunchback is the only Disney film I can think of where the protagonist pursues a romantic interest and doesn't get their affection back.
Hold on. I'm coming up short.
I mean, I know there are other Disney films where there is no romantic storyline at all, but I think this is the only one where the protagonist pursues the main love interest and she goes with somebody else and there is no other love interest to replace them. Obviously, in Frozen, Anna and Hans were together, but then it ends up being Anna and
Kristoff.
But that's a little bit different. But I don't think there's any other case where the protagonist pursues someone and it doesn't happen.
I think even if they don't end up together, there is some return of affection in general, besides the Hunchback.
And I wanted to bring this up because when I was a kid, when I saw that resolution, I thought, obviously, kid mind here, that what Disney was saying is that Quasimodo's looks were a deal breaker, so that anyone who had the unfortunate thing of being perceived as not looking good by society has no chance at love. And I know that's not what they were going for now, but my 10-year-old brain said that's the meaning of this story. So when I left the theater, I had a real sour taste in my mouth, and that wasn't the popcorn. Obviously, I know that interpretation isn't correct, but do you guys see where kids might pull that out of it?
Yes. But I think that it was more grounded in realism that way as much as it could be, because you don't always get the girl. And, yeah. You know, and it has nothing to do with physical appearance, though I am thankful for my wife's poor eyesight. That's another story.
Same here.
I thought it was a good story. It's not my pick for best story, but it was a good story.
Do you think that this is the Disney film in the Renaissance most intended for an adult audience?
Hands down.
Well, originally it was. It was created with an older audience in mind. I think one of the biggest issues the film experienced was that they still wanted it to be accessible to children because they adapted it from such a dark source material. They already had to change so much. And that would have been fine if they'd really aimed for maybe like a PG-13 or even more of like a PG. But I believe it actually did end up being rated G.
It was PG.
And really? Because I know a lot of the newer ones are rated PG that aren't nearly as dark.
Yeah, it was the only PG of the 90s, if I remember correctly.
And I think they really should have just aimed for more of a teenage audience. I mean, because that way they could have done the story the way they really probably intended. I think the addition of things like the gargoyles is more of an attempt to kind of lighten things up. But it's kind of like you can't have your cake and eat it too, like having it both ways. I mean, it can work sometimes, but like you said, like I think really the story itself was just too complicated for children to really grasp. I think the message was just, it's just too complex and too layered that children just, even with the fun of the gargoyles and the colors of the festival and all of that, it's just too mature. And I think it would have benefited the story if they just kind of given up to make it accessible for all children.
I honestly think if they wanted to adopt a French novel from the 19th century for kids, they could have done better adapting The Three Musketeers and doing that in a much like more lighthearted fashion. I know they did something with The Three Caballeros.
They did use Three Musketeers, yeah, but not like as an official canon Disney film. It was like a Mickey Mouse sort of side thing.
Yeah, it was a side thing, but if they actually did an actual Disney movie on it.
Like really pursued it.
Exactly.
I understand what you're saying, I agree.
Like they could have even given it the Robin Hood treatment and made it animals, but I think they could have done that one more lighthearted. But it is what it is, and I'm not saying it's a bad film, but it definitely doesn't appeal to the young kids. So animation, my picks. Hunchback was up there, but then I have my other two. And my runner-up is Pocahontas, because for no reason alone, then the scenery is so well done. You know, we record B&Q, at least B&Q headquarters is in North Carolina. Virginia is not far off. And I see my areas in that film. You know, it looks very realistic, but also gorgeous. The water is beautiful, again, like in Little Mermaid. The details of the ship are great, but the colors of the wind sequence alone is what I'm thinking of specifically. Very artistic, but in a great way to convey the emotion of that song and the connection of Pocahontas to nature. So that's my runner-up, but I think the best animation is actually, my pick is Aladdin. Because of a couple things. First of all, the Cave of Wonders blew my mind. Both the entrance to the Cave of Wonders, which was just amazingly wow, and then the inside was so frightening but exhilarating. Indiana Jones meets Hellfire, it's a later thing, but it's what a setting. the genie going crazy and doing modern stuff in the middle of a desert. The aesthetic for Aladdin has defined how we think of a desert landscape ever since. And that aesthetic was created in that movie. And, of course, the most iconic animation of the whole movie is the A Whole New World sequence. When they go across everywhere in the magic carpet ride, what a fantastically done marriage of animation and song. Probably the most impressive thing in my mind, impressive number that Disney had put together to that point. You could argue that the Beauty and the Beast song, the title song, outdid it in the integration of CGI a year later, but it still stands up today, the tour of the world, ending, I believe, at the Forbidden City, if I remember correctly. Yeah, what a journey Disney took us on in Aladdin with the animation. So they've just announced, actually, they're going to be doing a live-action adaptation of Aladdin, and I'm interested to see how the aesthetic will carry over to the live-action. What do you guys think about Aladdin's animation?
Sarah, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I agree. I think it's very nice. The colors used are so rich, and it really kind of puts you in a vibrant mood. It's very vivid. And I do agree the magic carpet ride, I think, is, in my opinion, the best animated scene of the Renaissance, if I had to pick one scene. Because just the motion of it, it makes you feel almost as if you're also on the carpet. I think it was very impressive in that sense. And yes, I do think overall it is a very nicely done film. I really love I've mentioned this, but the colors, it creates a really nice aesthetic. It's very high energy, which suits the mood of the film.
It feels hot.
Yes,
you know,
it really
makes
does.
You feel like you're in the desert. Ed, what do you think?
The character designs were a lot of fun in that. The things that they were able to do with Genie, and a lot of that I have to believe was Robin Williams ad-libbing, and then they just kind of went with it.
Yeah.
At least that's how I want to believe it happened. It was gorgeous. I mean, you take a character who has no dialogue like Carpet, and you animate it and give him personality. I mean, it was a great, great looking film. I mean, even down to the palace guards and the sultan. What was the tiger's name? Raja.
Raja.
Yeah, that's the name.
Yeah, I mean, great, great looking film. And Jafar was menacing. He looked menacing.
He did. He looked very sinister.
Which Matt, who obviously our beloved B&Q Matt, he wanted me to point out with Aladdin whenever it came up that he feels Jafar is unfairly maligned. He thinks Jafar actually is the most misunderstood Disney villain, because ultimately what he was doing was for the good of Agrabah, even if it was a selfish way to get there. But what do you guys think about that claim? Of course, this is the same man that said Jar Jar could be a Darth or a Sith Lord, so you know, we can take it for what we want. But what do you guys think about the claim that Jafar may have had Agrabah's best interests in his leadership?
I respectfully disagree. Like, I do think, like, I understand some of the basis for this, but Jafar himself, to me, the selfishness of the actions, the Sultan wasn't actually a bad ruler. There's no evidence in the film that the Sultan is really harming the kingdom. If there was, like, if there was anything that pointed to the Sultan being a really bad leader, then I guess it might make more sense. But to my memory, he seems like a fine leader. There's nothing to suggest otherwise. And Jafar himself, to me, his actions, especially towards Jasmine, are pretty lecherous. I don't think he exactly had the kingdom in mind.
Good word for it.
A little slave outfit and the hourglass.
You know, I think, is it fair to say that the Sultan is more aloof than negative? Like, he reminds me of sort of the absent-minded professor kind of character. He's always running around
right.
Like, ooh, ooh, ooh.
It's an archetype they used a lot. Like, Belle's father also is the same way.
Yeah,
he's very similar
like
to Belle's father,
yeah.
Maurice.
So I think that wraps up the animation. So we've got our top ones. We've got Aladdin, Little Mermaid. We've got Tarzan as a special mention, and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. So they all get points. Half point to Tarzan, but a point to the others. And now we move on to the best music. And I, at least when I envision this category, I'm not thinking of one song that's the best, but which film has the overall best best collected works, which includes the instrumentals, the incidentals that are going on in the background. Ed, I'll give you first crack at this one. Which movie's music is best?
Okay, I've got two honorable mentions on this one, one of which hasn't been mentioned at all, and since it takes place in the 90s, I'm going to count it. I absolutely loved A Goofy Movie.
And yes!
Powerline in that movie, you know, the pop songs and whatever, I loved it. But my other special mention was to Hercules, and I just loved, like, the song Go the Distance. That just always struck me. Mm-hmm. And I love the whole gospel feel to the rest of the music in that movie, and it was just really good. But for me, best music overall, I was born in the 80s. I love 80s music. I wonder if you can tell where I'm going with this. I picked Tarzan because Phil Collins did the music for that entire film. And yeah. Phil Collins is a fantastic music writer. Genesis and Phil Collins by himself. He had the You'll Be in My Heart song, which is a fantastic song. Two Worlds, which was like the main theme mm-hmm. of Tarzan.
True Colors Strangers, is Cyndi Lauper remake.
And Strangers Like Me, which was the one that they were playing while they were looking through the slides and showing Tarzan the different parts of the world. And then even the scene in the camp where the animals come in and they start banging around and doing the little scat music while they're doing it. I mean, just I love that whole scene, and I just think it was a great soundtrack.
Yeah, well, first of all, on Hercules, the decision to make the Fates into the singers was inspired.
I like that. That was good. Hercules was almost my pick for this one, but I had to go with Phil Collins.
And using the Fates to actually set up the mythology that was needed as the backstory, also genius, because most of the kids who are viewing Hercules don't have that knowledge that you'd have later in life of who Hercules is. Mm-hmm. So filling in those gaps with the intro musical number was a great idea. But yeah, Tarzan's music still stands out. The songs are great. And honestly, even though it's really well acclaimed and probably one of the best-selling Disney soundtracks, I'd say most people probably don't think of it when they think of Disney songs because they think of it as a Phil Collins album.
Well, it's so good. Well, another thing is the most of the those Renaissance films have a number where a character themselves is singing, and there's no big number like that in the Tarzan movie, with the exception of that scene in the camp where they're banging around on the different you know, stuff around the camp. There's no big Whole New World or, you know, Under the Sea or anything like that, and that's why people probably don't think about it.
It's a different kind of musical. It's not – the characters aren't singing and the music is coming in. It's constructed more like, you know, Forrest Gump in the sense that the songs are being sung by the actual singer – but they're being used to convey the emotion of the particular scene.
The Two Worlds song was playing when, I can't remember the female ape's name, when she finds Tarzan in the Kala, in the tree fort, and she finds him and all that. It was so good. I love that.
Absolutely. That's a great pick. So we've got Tarzan's got a point. Now, Sarah, what's your favorite overall music? I have a guess, but I think I want to see if you say it.
Well, I do actually have special mentions here. I want to mention Mulan, because overall it's not my favorite, but I think Reflection might be my favorite song in itself. Mm. The emotion behind it is so striking. And, of course, I'll Make a Man Out of You is a great song.
Donny Osmond for the win!
And the other mention I wanted to give was to Beauty and the Beast. Because overall, I really liked the songs. I think they really set the mood nicely, and I liked that they're paced throughout the movie. But my overall pick is probably the one you're thinking, and it's The Little Mermaid.
Yeah.
And I will say I am very fond of The Little Mermaid as a movie, but I really think the songs in themselves to me are just appealing to me. A lot of times, like the sort of it's called like the crowd song a lot of times. Songs like a lot of characters and a lot of colors. It's kind of the chance for the animators to show off their skills and, you know, Be Our Guest is an example of that. And usually they're kind of like my least favorite songs in the movie, but I actually really liked Little Mermaid, which is Under the Sea. I really like that number. I think maybe it's just the colors that draw me in, but also the song itself, the melody, I really like it. The words are clever. I think it's nice. I love Kiss the Girl. I love Part of Your World. Part of Your World is, to me, emotionally, it really strikes a chord. And for me, that's a big part of why I select things, especially for Disney movies, because I think part of the experience is to make you feel something. The scenes we really remember and the characters we really remember, a lot of times are the ones we really either made us really sad or really happy when we watched them as children. And to me, the desire present in the Part of Your World is something a lot of children also like somewhat experience. Like, they want their freedom too. They may not exactly know how to voice it yet, but I think it really strikes the chord, and it still does for a lot of people today. Looking back on it, they still want, you know, a little bit of something more. And I think overall, I would go with The Little Mermaid.
You know, knowing you as my sister, I'm pretty sure that Part of Your World is the song that defines your character the most. So, I can see where that has the resonance for you. Do you think Poor Unfortunate Souls is the best villain song?
No, actually.
No. Wow, okay.
I was going to discuss that more when we come up to the villains.
Oh, awesome. I'm not going to spoil it then. But it's a good one. It's a good one.
It is. I do really enjoy the song. It is one of my favorite villain songs.
But not the best. We'll see what it is in a second. As far as my music choices, I wish that Oliver and Company was eligible because I would choose that one. Because why should I worry? Why
should I care? Thank you for mentioning that movie.
But if Oliver and Company isn't in the Renaissance, unfortunately, so... And also, I would choose the jazz undertones of the Aristocats, but again, I can't. They're not in the Renaissance. So, all of your choices have been fantastic. I feel like we have to mention Aladdin and the Lion King because they're both so iconic as far as music. And I'm going to probably give the edge to The Lion King for my favorite music. I'm a huge Elton John fan, just like you're a fan of Phil Collins. So I love the music in The Lion King, even though he doesn't actually sing it in the film. He did help compose all the songs. The Lion King was the first soundtrack I ever... Well, my parents bought it, but it was the first soundtrack I ever owned. And when I was a kid, I was actually also a big wrestling fan. And I would used to have Simba as my wrestler fighting Hulk Hogan. And Simba's theme song coming to the ring was I Can't Wait to Be King. So I played that cassette until it broke.
You're out of the pride lines now, brother. You're in my world.
Pretty much. I actually did that promo for the Universal title, which is now actually a real thing. Go figure. But The Lion King music, every song is different, but every song is iconic in its own way. Hakuna Matata is a life philosophy if you want it to be. Just stop worrying about things. And yes, in the movie, Simba has to go back. But I think for all of us in our adult worlds now, it's kind of nice to have a song about, you know, screw it, you guys, I'm going home.
let me ask you.
Yeah.
Was it Jonathan Taylor Thomas and Matthew Broderick respectively singing that, or did they have doubles doing it?
I believe they did, and I believe they transitioned two-thirds of the way through this.
What I'm saying, was it actually the actor singing, or did they have another singing
that
voice?
That I do not know. Sarah, do you
I'm
know?
Pretty sure.
I think it was the same, but I can't give you a definitive answer on that one.
I know Broderick sings. I don't know if it's Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
It really sounded like Broderick singing as adult Simba. That's why I was kind of curious.
It's definitely him singing the adult Simba. I don't know if it's JTT singing. How long was Simba with, by the way?
It had
to be a good chunk of time.
I don't know how rapidly lions age, but it had to have been at least a couple of years. You would have to think.
Yeah, but that's why they need something like a rose. His mane isn't good enough. Oh, by the way, I need to have this as an aside while I'm bringing up Lion King. Do you guys know that if the Lion King occurred in real life, Simba would actually be shunned by the pride? Do you know why?
You're talking about after he came back?
Well, no, it doesn't matter about when he came back. There is a biological reason in the lion community why Simba would have been kicked out by the pride and Scar would have been the leader no matter what. Do you guys know what it is?
Would it have been his mane color?
Exactly right.
Because I remember reading about lions, in lion society,
the darker the mane means more testosterone, and lion males do not tend to fight if they have different colors of mane, because the ones that have lighter manes will simply avoid the fight and leave. And lions with lighter manes only get mates, are no other darker mane lions around to fight. So Simba would have had no chance to actually run the pride because he has a blondish mane. In fact, when you neuter a lion, his mane falls out. So most zoos actually spay the females because they don't want to lose the mane. And that's been science for them.
Very interesting. Now, that I did not know.
Yeah, so, but yeah, I think overall, the Lion King's music, there's a reason why the Lion King has been the big, well, with Beauty and the Beast, one of the biggest hits on Broadway for Disney. Because the music is so plotted out for a big number after big number. You have the romantic song, the group song. It's all there, and it's all done so well. I will give a nod as far as underrated music. I agree with Hercules. I agree with Mulan. You know, those deserve some praise. Pocahontas' music is also, I mean, you can't go wrong with music in the Renaissance, except maybe The Rescuers Down Under, which, to be fair, is not the point of that movie.
Right.
But I would say The Lion King, just for sheer, you know, testing of the time, just for its ability to last so long, and every single number in that movie is iconic. Every single one. I can name every song in that movie, and in some other cases, maybe I can't. I will pose a question to you that might prove controversial. Do either of you think that your respective picks for the Renaissance music have been eclipsed by either Tangled or Frozen in the music department?
Do I need to answer that? Yes, they have been eclipsed because everybody loves Let It Go. I mean, I love the Frozen soundtrack. I own the Frozen soundtrack, okay? Frozen's a great movie, and Tangled is a great movie, too. I'm actually kind of hard-pressed to remember the music from Tangled right now. It's been a little while since I've watched it. But I could say that my pick for music was easily eclipsed by either of those two films. And I actually need to make a correction. I said that nobody sang in that movie with the exception of my movie, Tarzan. I forgot that Nala actually sang "You'll Be in My Heart" to baby Tarzan.
Yes, she did.
So I needed to...
After. She started the song.
Yeah, I needed to correct myself before the fans corrected
me. She started it, but then Phil Collins sang most of it.
I think so, yeah. So, but yeah, easily eclipsed my pick.
What do you think, Sarah?
I think that I wouldn't say it's been eclipsed. I really love Tangled. I really love The Princess and the Frog. And I really love Frozen. And I think if we're talking about individual musical numbers, I think See the Light from Tangled was actually animation-wise and maybe song-wise my favorite overall of all of Disney. But I wouldn't say overall. Like, for Frozen, I really do love the songs, but I feel like the pacing's a bit disjointed. It's a very top-heavy film, and a lot of that is because the songs are all in a row. And maybe it's not the songs themselves' fault, but I think I do love songs, and I really love Let It Go, and I love For the First Time in Forever. But I think overall, the music doesn't really serve its full justice for the movie. I think it might have been used a bit better to further things along. But I do think the music in all of those films is really wonderful. The Princess and the Frog was also very good. It kind of gets kind of pushed aside by the success of the others a lot, but the music in it is very good.
Yeah, and Dr. Facilier deserves a mention as one of Disney's more menacing villains.
Yes, and his song is also very intimidating. I think it's very sinister.
Yeah, I mean, voodoo always is going to be a winner. So, speaking of villains, it is now time to turn to our wild card category. I almost did the Rumpelstiltskin Deary kind of thing, but that's for Once Upon a Time. Deary. So, the best villain, and of course, this is going to be, you know, this could be a whole episode in and of itself. We've done that before with Joker. This is an interesting thing. But for this episode, we're looking at the best villains in the Renaissance. And Sarah, you get to start. What's your best villain in the Renaissance?
I definitely have a pick here, and I think it's Frollo. I did touch on this earlier when I talked about the Hunchback, but it's because he's a very realistic villain to me. This could really have happened, and I'm sure has happened many times to women throughout history, and especially in this time period, a man in power could hold so much over a woman like Esmeralda, and it's very disconcerting, I think, even today. Esmeralda's a very relatable character. She's strong, and she's also, I think she's a wonderful character. Even if she wasn't, I think it would be pretty disconcerting, but especially since you relate to Esmeralda, and you're on her side, and Frollo is just very scary. He's driven by lust, which is a very real motive for a lot of crime, and everything he does, the imagery throughout his song is more magical, but his actions, they're all things that could really happen. It's very scary.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really the biggest contributing feature to why it's such a dark movie. But I think as far as a villain goes, I mean, everything is there. His character design itself, his motives, his song, it all goes perfectly along with it. I think definitely a scary one.
I'll ask a follow-up question, because I agree Frollo is a great pick. And to be fair, when I saw Hunchback as a kid, I think I had some pretty scary nightmares about Frollo. Do you think that it enhances the character or takes away from the character that he is a religious figure? How does that factor into it? Because obviously it's not some sort of mythological thing. He's a priest.
Right.
And a lot of the viewers of this are practicing Catholics or Christians. So how does that factor into his villainy? Because it's Disney hasn't ever before or since placed a religious figure as the antagonist.
Really, they don't use much religious imagery at all in general. I mean, they do in more subtle ways, but not so overtly as they do in Hunchback.
That's true.
I do think, personally, I think it adds to his villainy, if only just because it makes him more human. Because it kind of shows that it's a very gray area. People tend to think of like a religious institution as someone who helps others. A lot of times they do a lot of charity work. But this is not helpful at all. He's very openly villainous. Like, I mean, I guess in a way he still is respected and all, but you know that he has very clear intentions, and it's very nuanced because you could even say that he's more driven. His desire for Esmeralda might be even more because he is a religious figure. He's probably more restricted in his expression than other people.
I think he's
especially
the most
in this time frame.
I think he's the most calculating of the villains, maybe. I mean, Scar is to an extent, but Frollo is incredibly cold and calculating. He's very methodical.
Right.
In some ways, Gaston and Frollo are both driven by lust, but the way they act on it is the complete polar opposite.
Right, right. Gaston is more emotionally fueled. He has much more of a vivid temper. Like, you see Frollo get angry, but he's much more, he thinks about it more, kind of stews on it.
He gets angry. I mean, that's what Hellfire is, isn't it? The whole song is him stewing on.
Right. As he goes on, and the song gets progressively more and more intense. The music in it, the background, it just gets more and more sweeping, and it gets you caught up in his emotional state.
You feel his madness.
Right. He's really distended into just pure madness. And I think that's actually a key difference between him and Gaston. Gaston, you know, he's villainous, of course. But I don't think he's necessarily as unhinged as Frollo until maybe the very end when he goes and tries to kill the beast after the beast has shown him mercy.
I just think he's a conceited prick, but I don't think he's mad.
Right. He's arrogant, but he's not entirely mentally out. He's arrogant, and he's a bit goofy, and he's definitely a braggart, but he's I think that's actually what makes Frollo kind of scarier, that despite his madness, he's still so calculating.
Yeah, in some ways, and this is a bit of a spoiler for Wreck-It Ralph, I see strangely some parallels between Frollo and King Candy.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that they are so unhinged but are able to put out an open facade of just pure calculation with what they've done to get to their power. And in both cases, it's a very trusted figure in seemingly an innocuous position who is using that power in a secret way to do horrible things.
Right, you're right. I've actually never thought about that before, but that's very true. They're both people that other people think they can rely on, or at least would hope so, especially in the case of King Candy, because he's entirely a twist. But yes, I would agree with that.
So we've got Frollo, so Hunchback gets a point. Ed, who's your pick for the best villain?
All right, I'll start with my runner-up, and actually it's two. I agree with Sarah. Frollo is a very menacing individual. He is a runner-up for me. And what you were saying about the overzealous nature of his religion, a lot of the stories I've read or watched or whatever, sometimes an overly zealous religious person, regardless of the religion they're practicing, can make them terrifying. But my other runner-up is Scar. I thought long and hard about this. again, it was that end of innocence thing. Scar killed Mufasa, and that's why, and he was calculating, maybe not as calculating as Frollo, but his plan, in essence, succeeded and would have succeeded altogether if Simba had decided not to come back. But, and this will come out of left field, and I've mentioned this movie a time or two through the show, my best villain, based on the scope of the plans and the execution, is Hades from Hercules. Mm-hmm. Every other villain on this list, you know, in the Renaissance, is... does Ariel live in Atlantis? Is that where... it's been years since I've watched it. Is it Atlantis or is it something else?
It's called Atlantica. It's kind of a loosely based type of situation.
Okay. Well, Ursula was trying to take over Atlantica, right? You know, Scar was trying to take over the Pride Lands. Frollo was trying to be, you know, kind of a monarch there in Paris. Hades' plan was not only to take over the entirety of the world, but also Olympus. And let's talk about how he was going to do that. He had the soothsayers, whatever they're called, the ones that could see into the future.
The fates, I believe.
The fates, you're right. And he saw that into the future he could take over Olympus if Hercules does not fight in that battle. He orchestrates two demons, Pain and Panic, to go kidnap Hercules, turn him human, and then kill him. Think about that for a minute. All the levity in that movie, that was the plan. And then not to mention how devious he was. You know, he was conniving. He was a shoe salesman, or a used car salesman. I almost went Al Bundy there. A used car salesman kind of, you know, talked to him. But then he did things like he took Megara's soul in exchange for returning her lover's soul, and then he ditched her. And then he used her to get to Hercules, and then eventually to give up Hercules, to give up his powers to save her, whilst not knowing that Meg was working for him the entire time. His plan all but succeeded. He had already taken out Zeus before Hercules managed to come back and rally and fight and take him down. And even at the end, he was still conniving. Meg's soul was swirling in the river Styx, and he told Hercules, "You got to go in there and get her." And not knowing that that was the only thing that would give him his god powers back, but that would have killed Hercules as well. And that's why at the end of it, because of the scope and the means to which he did all these things, also he's James Woods, ooh, piece of candy, but that's why he's my pick, just due to the scope of it.
And the hair. The hair
and
flames.
Yes, fantastic.
Yeah, Hades... I wonder if they always intended for him to be so sarcastic, but it makes it so deliciously evil.
Oh my god, when Pain or Panic, whichever one of them it was, came in wearing the Hercules merchandise sandals, what are those? I love that.
Yeah, Sarah, you have any thoughts on Hercules or Hades?
I do think he is a good villain. I mean, personally, I really find him amusing. His sarcasm, I think it strikes a chord with me. It's the kind of humor I like. I have always kind of wondered about him, though. Like, it seems like he could have done things a little differently to me. Then I guess all the villains could, and that's kind of why they have their downfall, because they always, you know, like, for the viewers in hindsight, you can be like, why didn't he do that? Like, why didn't he make sure the baby was dead? Or why didn't he give this to someone else? Like, the pink drink he gave to Hercules. It seems like if he had the capacity to make that, he could have maybe slipped it to other gods as well. But that's sort of nitpicky, because I think every villain kind of has those tendencies.
Yeah.
Like Scar could have made sure Simba was, you know, dead and not come back.
And for like, more on that, please listen to our recent episode, Which Mega Villain Scheme Really Should Have Succeeded, because Matt and I really took down some of those kinds of things. The cigarette smoking man in the X-Files, the Borg in Star Trek, etc. So we took down a lot of those kinds of things where the deus ex machina comes in, or the villain didn't do quite enough. So my pick's
their problem.
Yeah,
they don't do quite enough. But overall, I do really like Hades, because I think, like, as a character, he's the most enjoyable villain to watch, in my opinion.
He's hilarious. He is hilarious.
He's the funniest villain. So, you know, my picks, I was going to go potentially with Frollo, so I'm glad you picked him. And I was considering going with Hades, so I'm glad that, Ed, you picked him. And I have to do an honorable mention to Ursula. I also want to do an honorable mention for Percival McLeach, the villain of Rescuers Down Under.
Nice, nice.
Because George T. Scott, Patton himself, is voicing this villain who is a poacher. And as a lover of animals, a poacher is a horrific villain. And, you know, it's almost like the villain of Bambi come to life in a crazier way. So I gotta give an honorable mention to Percival MacLeach. But my pick for the top villain of the Renaissance is actually Shan Yu of Mulan. And it's for the same reason, the scene I mentioned earlier where the whole town is gone. And see, I agree with you, the stakes are huge with Hades, but they're also huge here because Shan Yu is trying to literally overthrow the largest empire on Earth. Disney based his physical features and his characterization on two men, Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan. And for anybody who's out there with a historical bent, you cannot get a much better villain than the bastard child of Attila the Hun and Genghis freaking Khan. And putting them together is genius, and giving him the bird that is so menacing in and of itself, making him have no magical powers at all, but having so much power in the context of the film. He's considered the darkest villain comparable to Frollo because of all the murder he commits. And yet, just like Hannibal Lecter, just like Jaws, he's only on screen for a very little bit of time. But his impact so overweighs the amount of screen time that he has that he has to be given this honor in my book. What a great villain. And he deserved the explosive ending that he got.
I agree with him being a choice. And the scene that sticks out to me is the scene where they're sending the two Chinese guys, the two messengers, back to warn them that the Huns are coming. And then he looks over to the archer and says, how many soldiers does it take to deliver a message? Just one. And then shoots and kills the other one. I mean, that was a pretty menacing scene. That was pretty nice.
Yeah, I love the fact, so I'm looking at his page on the Disney Wiki, and they have a likes and dislikes section. His likes are power and conquest, which of course, you know, that makes sense. What his dislike is women pretending to be men.
Dr. Frankenfurter.
It's like, okay, that's a really hyper... Like, I don't think his first concern was, you know, that practice, you know, of cross-dressing. That wasn't his first concern when he was trying to take over China. I think he'd be perfectly okay with people doing it if they weren't trying to thwart him taking over the empire. But it's the internet, so, you know, at least it's not a lolcat.
Yeah, Disney Wiki, it can be a useful resource, but it's not, it doesn't really require a citation.
And they're combining his enemies from the video game Kingdom Hearts to his bio from the movie. So it lists his enemies as Mulan, Mushu, and Donald Duck.
Let's not forget Sora.
That's wonderful. Can you imagine Donald Duck in Mulan? Or maybe Daisy Duck pretending to be a Donald Duck. That would be...
I'll make a duck out of you.
No. I think Goofy in this scenario would be infinitely funnier.
Oh, wait, Goofy's also listed?
Yes.
Can you imagine that?
Wilbur.
In that Goofy voice, and he drops the fireworks, and that's how he defeats the enemy.
Goofy did it all. Goofy is the secret. He's the Goofy is secretly all the characters. He is secretly Ooh. Emperor Snoke.
Who's your favorite possum?
Man. Oh, Goofy 2, Electric Boogaloo. It's actually called a Goofy.
You know what? That was actually... I liked the sequel, even if it was direct-to-video or whatever. I actually enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think we should do a B&Q at some point on the best direct-to-video Disney feature.
That would be an interesting one, because Aladdin 3 was direct-to-video, and that was actually a good film, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they're a very different class of movies. They really outsourced a lot of those...
Oh,
to
yeah.
other places. If you look at animation side by side, it's drastically different. But of course, when you watch the films themselves, you're not comparing them side by side, so it's much less noticeable.
Of course.
And it would be interesting.
They're trying to make you forget Fantasia 1978 featuring all music from the Bee Gees, but, you know, And Mickey will be staying alive. Sorry. That would be a horrible thing. But it'd be a great parody, fans. If you know how to put them together, please send us Fantasia1978. That's our hashtag for this week's BNQ, Fantasia1978. So, it's now time, here at the end, for all of us to pick the most magical, the most wonderful, the most effervescent, the best Disney film of the Renaissance. Ed, I will give the floor to you first. What is your pick for best overall film?
Again, just on the impact it had, I really feel that The Lion King takes it. It's just, we didn't even get into the fact that Jeremy Irons' fantastic portrayal as Scar, and just, yes, it has the fart jokes, yes, it has the stupid comedy, but it was a complete hero's journey, whether it was a reluctant hero or not, because Simba was a reluctant hero. They kind of had to kick him in the pants to get him moving, but I just think that it stands out, and as you mentioned, how fantastic the music is, even though that wasn't my choice, it the soundtrack's fantastic. Just overall, to me, it's a great film, and it's the hands-down winner to me. And, you know, that's all I got to say on it.
So Lion King has a point. Sarah, what is your choice for best overall?
Well, I think this is actually a bit interesting because Ed chose the same for his story and overall, I believe. Didn't he also choose Lion King?
Yes.
Yes.
And I'm going to do the same thing. I think overall my favorite is Beauty and the Beast. And I don't know if that's entirely reflective on the story. But for me, it's because even though I didn't choose it in all the categories, it's very strong in all the categories. It's very close to being at the top in everything. And to me, that accumulates into overall making, for me, the best movie. I think the characters are wonderful. I think Belle as the lead character, maybe especially as like a bookish girl, as a child especially, I read all the time and it was very easy to relate to Belle. But I think Belle's relatable for a lot of people. She loves her family. She's driven and she puts everything into action.
She's not royal. She comes from a peasant background. That helps.
Yeah, she's not. And I think the thing about her is she's not as like overtly action oriented as someone like Mulan. But at the same time, she makes things happen herself. And she's one of the first leading Disney ladies to really do that. I wouldn't say the very first because Ariel does that to some extent, but Belle does the same thing in I think a bit more of an impactful way. And the movie overall, I think the music is great. The story is great. I think everything about it, to me, the animation is fantastic. The scene, I think we need to mention the ballroom scene at some point. The ballroom scene where Belle and the Beast come together and dance. It was, you know, it was one of the first real uses of CGI. It was used amazingly well. And especially for that time, it's a very impressive look overall. The castle is beautiful. That dance, that music, everything about the mood, it fit perfectly. I guess for me, it's a very romantic, not in the sense of like love story romantic, but the sense of like fairy tale romantic movie. And I just really appreciate that. I think that the colors used in the animation and the animation itself, it really lends itself to a certain aesthetic. The songs support that. The characters support that. I even think Gaston is a good villain fit for the movie. I think he fits perfectly well. And, of course, the conflict isn't just then one villain. It's in a sort of mob mentality, which is, again, a realistic and really scary thing to think about. And also in prejudice. And I think the message of the movie is it's important. I know at this point it seems like such a cliche not to judge a book by its cover or something like that. But I think it's good to have that message relayed in such a way that it doesn't feel like it's being like hit over your head. It feels natural. But at the same time, it sort of lends viewers to relate to Belle's understanding and Belle's way of looking at the world. Of course, at first, she's terrified by the Beast, but she doesn't really judge him based on her appearance. She judges him based on his actions. And I think that's really something I think is important. I really appreciate the film. And it is a bit of a hard decision for me, because even though I do love overall Beauty and the Beast, it's not actually my favorite of the Renaissance. I just think it's the best movie overall. And I think a lot of the movies are really, really good. I think all of them are great in their own ways. But overall, my pick is Beauty and the Beast.
You know, it's funny you mentioned the distinction between best film and favorite, because, you know, I see that to a certain extent, too. Because I think my favorite growing up was probably Beauty and the Beast. I could see an argument that Ed's making, though, that Lion King is the best film. And honestly, those were the two that I was waffling between. Whew. Beauty and the Beast and Lion King are the top two in my mind. The others are fantastic, but those are the top two. Now, which one is the top one? Oh, man. I think I'm going to give it to Beauty and the Beast, because I agree with Sarah's point that it might not be the single best movie in any given in any of the four categories, but it's so close to the top in all of them that it gives it the edge. So it's consistently good across all the facets. Especially when I think, maybe the reason I'm picking Beauty and the Beast, when I think of Disney, it's the very first movie I think of to this day. Like, in my mind, I picture the ballroom scene. I, you know, picture the opening scene with the stained glass and the beautiful strings in the background. That's what I think of as the quintessential Disney film. Not Snow White, not Cinderella, not Lion King, no offense to the Lion King, and not Frozen, not Tangled. I think of Beauty and the Beast as the Disney film. So I guess I have to give it to that for no other reason than that. But like we've said a lot in this episode, you can't make a bad choice. And it's hard because everyone has a personal preference with this. And, you know, Beauty and the Beast, I think, is my personal favorite. But I could make a case that I really did enjoy Pocahontas a lot, you know, in some ways. I really did enjoy Aladdin, I think, even more as a kid than Beauty and the Beast. I love the genie character. He's the best character, one of the best characters Disney ever did. Thank you, Robin Williams. But I think Beauty and the Beast is the best film overall. That said, if I could go through all the Disney works, maybe I would throw in The Great Mouse Detective because I'm a sucker for Sherlock Holmes.
Rat again!
Yes, and I wanted to mention that movie because it deserves more more coverage than it gets. But, yeah. But you can't go wrong. So we have Beauty and the Beast, 2 votes, and The Lion King, 1 vote. But listeners, you may have a different opinion. In fact, I think you will, because everyone who's seen these films, everyone who grew up with these films, has an opinion about them. Maybe you think there's a couple films in there that aren't good, that don't deserve praise, and they have, you know, bigger flaws than we see in them. Maybe there's one that we didn't discuss at all. Maybe you're a huge fan of The Rescuers Down Under. Maybe you're a huge fan of Tarzan and you think that deserves more praise. Maybe you're a really big fan of the stuff in the early 2000s like Dinosaur, Treasure Planet, and think that the Renaissance really needs to be redefined to start including those movies. Whatever the case may be, let us know. Please send us a tweet at BNQ Podcast or send us an email. Our email address is bnqfeedback@gmail.com, bignerdyquestions@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and if you send us your picks along with a brief explanation, we would be happy to read it on the air, and Ed and Sarah and I will talk about it, and whoever the panel is, I'm sure that we have other panelists who would love to get their opinions in on this one, so please send us that, and if you also have any other ideas that you'd like our Disney panel to come back to in later episodes, please let us know that as well. So we have one more piece of business to take care of.
Yes.
We have to kill Jar Jar Binks. And tonight, Jar Jar Binks decided that he fell in love with a beautiful Gungan girl, but he needed to trade something. So he found a sea witch and gave away his voice. In so doing, the sea witch was hailed as the hero of the world for depriving us of the most annoying thing George Lucas ever created. And Jar Jar, when he could no longer protest, was shot in the head. Jar Jar Binks is dead, but B&Q will persist. Thank you very much, Ed.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, and hopefully we'll be a part of your world next time. This is Josh signing off for Big Nerdy Questions.